Your Honor, I'd like to present to the ladies and gentlemen of the jury with Exhibit B, a bag of Sweet Tango apples.
Mmm, boy, these apples are delicious.
And zesty? Mmm, and sweet.
Best I ever tasted.
Your Honor, I object.
Overruled. Court dismissed. We need to recess to the grocery store for some Sweet Tango apples.
You love a great mystery, but not in the produce aisle. Be sure to reach for Sweet Tango, the most delicious tasting apple money can buy. Investigate where you can get yours at sweettango.com.
If you ever happen to find yourself driving down West Linden Street in Boise, Idaho, you might notice the house that sits at number 805. Covered in a layer of dirt, boarded up, windows broken, and trash scattered all over the yard, the large two-story craftsman-style home looks like an abandoned set for a horror film. But in this case, the true story is much more terrifying than fiction. Known around town as the Boise Murder House, or as the Chop Chop House by those with a dark sense of humor, it was the scene of a gruesome homicide that occurred here more than three decades ago, when a young man was brutally slain in the house's basement. Some believe it happened because of a drug deal gone wrong, but whatever led up to the slaying, when all was said and done, the killers had dismembered the body and discarded the 26 pieces over 100 miles away. Though they believed they'd never be caught, fate had other ideas. Welcome to American Hauntings, the podcast dedicated to the history, hauntings, legends, lore, and the dark side of American history. And welcome to a special Halloween bonus episode that goes along with Season 8, which we call Home. This one was written and performed by Troy Taylor, that's me, and produced by Cody Beck. As you already know, we've spent this season on a cross-country trip in search of America's murder houses, relics of time and crime gone by. We're going behind the locked doors of both famous and little-known places where murder and violence have left lingering ghosts behind. And this one is no exception. Let's unlock the door to the Boise Murder House and step inside to see what's waiting for us there. On June 29, 1987, California native Preston Muir was in Boise, Idaho for a funeral. After the service, he and a few of the mourners, including two sketchy characters, Daniel Rogers and Darren Cox, got involved in a drunken brawl. The police were called, and all of those involved in the fight were cited for disorderly conduct. Then, later that evening, while sobering up at his sister's apartment, Preston received a telephone call. When he picked up the receiver, a voice he didn't recognize threatened to kill him, presumably because of the fight that had occurred earlier. The line went dead after the threat, and curious to know who'd placed the call, Preston called Daniel Rogers to see if he had any idea who might be threatening him. But instead of answering him outright, Rogers suggested they meet up in the parking lot of a nearby convenience store. Preston was only 21 years old, but he wasn't an idiot, so he took a baseball bat to the meeting with him, just in case. But after a brief chat, he must have felt safe because he invited Rogers and Cox to come back to his sister's house, where they spent several hours talking about the mysterious phone call, as well as some of the guns that had recently been stolen from Rogers. By 10 p.m. or so, Preston's sister had had enough. She was tired and needed to sleep, and the guys had to go. So Preston, Rogers, and Cox piled into Rogers' car, and it was then that Preston volunteered that while he hadn't taken the missing guns, he believed he knew who did. Angry, Rogers suggested they go looking for the thieves, and they drove around for more than an hour, but found no trace of them. It was now just after midnight on July 30th, and the trio drove to Rogers' house at 805 West Linden Street. Tired and irritated, another argument broke out between the three men, and with his anger boiling over, Rogers produced a .357 Magnum, and he shot Preston in the shoulder. While outnumbered and terrified, that baseball bat long forgotten, Preston, bleeding badly from the wound, made a desperate attempt to escape. Crashing out of the front door, he ran to the nearest house and began banging on the door, begging for help. The neighbor was inside, but was too afraid to open the door. He called the police instead, telling the operator there was a man outside, screaming for someone to, quote, let go of me. He followed that with an anguished yell. Peeking out the window, the neighbor saw a clearly injured man being chased down the street by two unknown men. The neighbor couldn't see anything else, but we know that Preston's pursuers caught up with him, dragging him back to Rogers' house. With nowhere else to run, he was taken down to the basement, where he was shot once in the back and again in the head. While waiting for the police to respond to the 911 call he'd made, the neighbor spotted two men hosing off the front porch of the house next door. As he watched, one of the men started walking around the property with a flashlight, as if searching for something. Minutes passed, then an hour, then 2 hours. Still no sign of the police. The neighbor, the only person on the block who'd reported the disturbance, eventually got tired of waiting and fell asleep. It didn't matter, though. Cops never showed up. The next morning, the neighbor called 911 again. He repeated what he told the dispatcher the previous night and had something to add. There was blood all over the screen door of his house where the man had been knocking. He hadn't noticed that in the dark. This finally convinced police officials to send a patrol car to the scene. When the first officer arrived, he saw the bloody marks on the door, but he also discovered a blood trail that led from the caller's house to the place next door at number 805. As he searched the neighborhood, he also found blood spatter on sidewalks, curbs, and on several other doors on the block. Apparently, the victim of whatever horror had taken place the night before had knocked on several doors as he fled for his life. Tragically, though, not a single person had answered his pleas for help. Knowing immediately he was way out of his depth, the patrol officer called for reinforcements. Once additional officers and detectives arrived, they tried unsuccessfully to get someone to answer the door at 805 West Linden. One of the detectives placed a call and applied for an emergency search warrant, and when it arrived, they forced their way into the home. They were greeted by a scene that looked like it was a slaughterhouse. The place was awash in blood, especially the basement. And as they searched the place, they uncovered guns, drugs, and a large amount of cash. But no bodies. And there was a good reason for that. It was later discovered that after killing Preston, Rogers and Cox had dismembered his body, placing the severed limbs and parts in garbage bags. Once that grisly task was completed, they loaded the remains into a car that belonged to Rogers' wife and drove nearly 100 miles to the Brownlee Reservoir, located along the Idaho-Oregon border. The body parts were dumped there, and then they tossed the bloody clothing and gloves they'd worn that night into a dumpster. They believed they'd committed the perfect crime and would never be caught. Well, they were wrong. But since Preston hadn't yet been reported missing and there was no body at the house, the best the police could do was to charge Rogers and his wife with various drug offenses. Rogers was picked up that afternoon, and a week later, the bags containing the various parts of Preston Murr were uncovered from the reservoir. Almost immediately, Rogers and Cox were indicted for the young man's murder. Though both men had vowed to take the secret of the murder to the grave, they quickly turned on each other, both hoping for a better deal. But it was Cox who talked first. He swore that he'd only been acting on his friend's orders and quickly told investigators everything they needed to know to save his own neck. Rogers was tried first. When called to the stand in his own defense, he claimed that Cox and Murr had been involved in a knife fight in his basement. He claimed that when things turned ugly, he tried to intervene, but Preston had lunged at him. Fearing for his life, he'd fired his pistol just to scare him. He never meant to hit him, he told the jury. Rogers went on to say that as Preston bolted for the door, Cox had grabbed the gun from him and chased after the fleeing man. He never left the basement, he claimed, but he did hear two gunshots outside. Cox returned soon after and casually announced that Preston was dead. Rogers swore that everything he said was the truth, but the jury didn't believe him. He was convicted of first-degree murder and sentenced to life in prison with the possibility of parole after 10 years. His legal team appealed his conviction in the 90s on the grounds that his property was illegally searched and any evidence obtained should have been thrown out. But the appeal was denied, and Rogers remains behind bars today. Cox, who unlike Rogers had cooperated with the police, was tried and convicted on the lesser charge of being an accomplice to murder. He served 6 years before being released and vanishing into history. With the murder solved and the killers captured and locked up, that should have been the end of the story of the Boise murder house. But as it turned out, it was just the beginning. The crime scene was cleaned up a long time ago, but a darkness has been lingering at 805 West Linden Street ever since the night of that murder. It's unclear what happened to the house in the years that immediately followed the incarceration of Daniel Rogers at the Idaho State Correctional Center to serve out his life sentence, but rumor has it, it became a rental property that was almost impossible to rent. One tenant after another moved into the house, but none of them stayed long. After reporting strange happenings in the place, mostly in the basement, residents packed up their belongings and fled, breaking the lease over and over again. In 2000, the house was purchased by James Howell, who also offered it as a rental property. Apparently unbothered by the stories of fleeing tenants that were told about the house, he began catering to students from nearby Boise State University who were looking for off-campus housing. But those students soon had weird stories of their own. And even those who weren't convinced that the place was haunted, they all agreed there was something off about the place. Joe W. Was a BSU student and former tenant, and he admitted the basement was creepy and had a weird feel. "We used to take people down there to scare them," he said. "I never saw any ghosts, but you could tell something wasn't right." A Boise resident identified as Rachel R. said that her family almost bought the house when it went up for sale in 2000, and to this day, she says she gets anxious thinking about when they toured the home. She said, "It looked like the place had been abandoned, and the basement was by far the creepiest part." But an account by a previous tenant, identified only as Dan, goes beyond just creepy. According to his story, he and his girlfriend were upstairs one night when they heard the unmistakable sounds of someone coming up the steps. Since they had friends over that evening, they weren't too concerned about it until no one appeared. Not sure what to make of this, they went down to the living room and asked if anyone in the group had been upstairs, but none of them had. Wondering if someone had gotten into the house without them knowing about it, they went outside to look around, but didn't find anyone. Dan said that when he turned around to go back inside, he saw what he described as a big, black, oily-looking thing in the window of an upstairs bedroom. He couldn't tell exactly what it was, but he was sure it wasn't human. He saw the shadowy figure move back from the window and toward the bedroom door before it disappeared. Moments later, it reappeared, but now on the front porch. As he watched, Dan claimed the oily blackness moved along the railing of the porch, slowly growing in size as it came toward him. Frozen in place, he said that the black shape moved right through him. He described the sensation as, quote, "one of the weirdest, most disturbing things I've ever felt, and just telling this makes me feel it again. It's like ice fingers sinking into my shoulders." Having no desire to go back into the house at that moment, the couple headed straight to a nearby convenience store where they called their friends inside the house so they could tell them to get out. They didn't know exactly what they'd seen, but they did know that there was something strange going on in the house and they wanted no part of it. And in fact, Dan never returned to the house again after that night. A woman named Christine, who used to live down the street from the house, stated that she was passing by the place one day and saw a woman banging on a second floor window, her face frozen in a look of sheer terror. Knowing the house was empty at the time, Christine ran away as fast as she could. From that moment on, she made a point of staying as far away from the house as she could, preferring to walk on the other side of the street if she couldn't avoid that block. Other former tenants have spoken up about their experiences in the house too. Seeing strange shadows, hearing disembodied footsteps on the stairs, and terrified voices that emanate from the basement where most of the strange activity seems to occur. Despite these and many other chilling tales about the house, though, owner James Howell insists the place is not haunted. He often cites the narratives of other tenants who say they never experienced anything paranormal in the house. There are no ghosts haunting the home, he says, but there isn't much he can do about its reputation. He's never been afraid in the house and doesn't believe it's haunted, but can't deny after the murder that occurred there in 1987. He doesn't blame those people who believe that it is. Thanks for listening to this Halloween bonus show, and thanks for listening to American Hauntings. If you love the show, we hope you'll share it with your friends, neighbors, everyone you know, and if you happen to be hate listening to us, well, thanks for your support. Still counts. You can reach us via email, drop us a text on the Haunt Line at 217-791-7859, or check us out on social media. Cody and I are both on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, which we refuse to call X. To find out more about the show, check out our website at AmericanHauntingsPodcast.com, which features show notes, links, and, well, sometimes photos that go along with each episode. So until next time, goodbye, so long, and see you later. And happy Halloween.
Your Honor, I'd like to present to the ladies and gentlemen of the jury with Exhibit B, a bag of Sweet Tango apples.
Boy, these apples are delicious.
And zesty, and sweet.
Best I ever tasted.
Your Honor, I object. Overruled. Court dismissed. We need to recess to the grocery store for some Sweet Tango apples.
You love a great mystery, but not in the produce aisle. Be sure to reach for Sweet Tango, the most delicious tasting apple money can buy. Investigate where you can get yours at SweetTango.com.